This is Ship It with Justin Garrison and Autumn Nash. If you like this show, you will love The Changelog. It's software news on Mondays, deep technical interviews on Wednesdays, and on Fridays, an awesome talk show for your weekend enjoyment. Find it by searching for The Changelog wherever you get your podcasts. Ship It is brought to you by Fly.io. Launch your app in 5 minutes or less. Learn how at fly.io.
Hey friends, I'm here with a friend of mine, Dave Rosenthal, CTO at Sentry. So Dave, I've heard you say trace connected before. I know that the next big frontier for Sentry is tracing this metrics platform. But how'd you get there? And what do developers need to know about how you're thinking about this product?
Before I came to Sentry, Sentry was sort of working on a metrics product. We started building that metrics product in a more traditional way with the metrics just kind of being more like kind of just disconnected. They're just like another source of data. They're another table somewhere. Yeah, you can line them up by time. Sure, you can drill into them a little bit, but really they weren't connected to that trace. And we took a big step back from that after trying it ourselves, after trying it with users, and realizing that there was a whole class of things we wanted to be able to do that you couldn't do with this kind of disconnected metrics. And so, you know, we changed our APIs, we changed our approach, and we're kind of now really on a very clear direction of building a metric system that isn't one of these kind of like legacy disconnected metric systems. It's trace connected so that we can get that kind of rich debugging context when you actually dig into a real problem. And you know, there's trade-offs. It's not quite as easy to just like log random metrics at random times into a system. You have to put the thought when you're building the telemetry into how this metric actually does relate to the structure of the code that's running underneath. But we think it's the right trade-off for users because it's like a little extra time to figure that connection out. But then when you actually go to use the data, the connection's there for you. So small investment, big return. And it's just an example of how we're kind of making decisions internally to set our users up for success with this trace connected idea.
Very cool. It's cool to see how you think about getting to the end result with any of these products you're building. It's so cool to see behind the scenes the way you think and the way you iterate. Okay, friends, go to sentry.io. Use our code changelog to get $100 off the team plan. That's basically almost 4 months for free. Sentry.io. Use the code changelog. Don't use anything else. Use our code. It's good for you. Once again, sentry.io.
Hello and welcome to Ship It, the podcast all about what happens after you get push. I'm your host, Justin Garrison, and with me as always is Autumn Nash. How's it going, Autumn?
Hey, everyone.
Today on the show, we have a conversation I've been looking forward to for quite a while because I've been interested in ActivityPub and Mastodon and specifically like how that infrastructure runs and how to scale that and just how the servers talk to each other. And I like decentralized things in the non-scammy financial ways. It was kind of something that
you had to be specific about that.
Like, I love the internet, right? And the internet is the most decentralized system you can get, and it scales really well for a lot of reasons. And then I see this like Mastodon thing that's like, hey, we can kind of do that internet thing, but like portable on social networks and let people connect. I've been blogging for a very long time. I used to have a list of web ring sites that I also would send people to. And if people are old enough to remember web rings.
Wait, what's web ring?
Web rings weren't like a way to communicate between sites, but it was a way to like list out like sites you're also reading. Right? It was like a recommendation engine for people that had websites. They're like, I have a blog. You should also, if you like my blog, you probably like these other people's blogs. And they would link to other people. And so it was like a discovery engine before things had discovery engines. It was all like personally curated. And then no one ever updated them.
You're like my favorite old best friend. Like,
it's weird because I never grew up with a computer.
I know. I've had a computer since I was like I fell in love with computers in elementary school. And you're like, I got one in college. How, yeah. Sir? Like, did you just not come out of your dorm room at some point? Like, did you just lock yourself in there and you found every... How did you have time to date Beth? Like, it is a miracle that you got married. Like,
we met because I fixed her computer.
That's so cute.
I didn't tell you that.
That is the cutest nerd good thing ever.
I needed a job in college, and I got a job because there was a lab across the hall. The dorm room had a lab, which is what I used all day, every day, because I had no computer.
Can we talk about how cute and nerdy that is? You fixed her computer, and then you were married for 20 years. That is.
I didn't fix her computer, though. I worked on her computer. No, I didn't sabotage it. It was a whole thing where
he was like, she has to come back if it doesn't turn on ever.
I worked at the IT departments. It was a student IT run thing. And so we would repair computers. We also were one of the first colleges that had Wi-Fi throughout the whole school. And so every year when people would come, they would come with desktops. No one had laptops in 2001. And so they would come with desktops and like, I need to get on the network. We're like, we're going to install a Wi-Fi card for you.
You went to college when there were no laptops.
Yeah, we had a laptop rental program so that people could rent laptops if they wanted to. And those came with optional Wi-Fi. It was it was the thing. But she came with a desktop that was an old, was MacTel.
Like she carried a desktop into your?
Yeah, everyone moved a desktop. Everyone came with desktops. And she needed a Wi-Fi card to connect. And it was in our shop or whatever. And then we're like, oh, we need to go deliver this to the customer. We have to go bring it back to the dorm room. And they're like, okay, I was working at the time. Hey, where is it? And like, oh, it's someone else knew her. Someone's like, oh, it's Beth. I was like, who's this? Like, I don't know where this person is. Like, oh yeah, she has a shaved head. And I'm like, I've seen her around. I want to meet her. Can I please bring that computer back? And I literally was like, let me take over this ticket. I delivered the computer and I did none of the work.
Okay, but this is the cutest thing I've ever heard of. He was like, bro, this is my ticket. Like, don't even look at the ticket. Like, I'm going.
I'm pointing over on my left and I can see the computer. I still have the computer. The reason we met, I still have the computer. It is a terrible knockoff Mac when Apple used to license their light operating system.
This is like the cutest thing ever. Like, this is the most warm and fuzzy. It's like, okay, I believe in love again. Like,
that is how we met because I didn't fix her computer. I delivered her computer after it was fixed.
That is the most adorable story ever. Like, it's so cute. I might have like a small tear like right there. Like, it's so warm and fuzzy. Like, that is the cutest story ever.
Before Bumble and dating apps. And
damn it, you mean I have to fix people's computer to find my soulmate? This is bullshit.
If you can fix someone's printer, that might be like a new, like, hey, I can
help. I want someone who can fix my printer.
When's your 3D printer coming?
Never.
sorry, Beth. Anyway,
that's not what we charge back. Okay, like I'm so bitter. Oh, like, there's do you see the filament on the ground? Do you see it? It's just haunting me, and like it's
boxes
like
boxes of filament,
tons of filament. But you're sad, and you have no 3D printer.
You're over there with like a blow dryer trying to melt it into some sort of like figure. Anyway, sorry, that's not what you're talking. Preston Duster is on the call. You are a infrastructure architect at Twilio, which is not at all what we want to talk about.
No, not today.
I have questions, though. What does Twilio do?
What does Twilio do? So I would call us a telecommunications company, right? So we kind of grew up by building APIs that abstract the complexity of doing things like making phone calls or sending SMS. We've grown into a lot of different channels now and into almost like the contact center space.
Like, who uses Twilio and for like what? Maybe like
what's I'm a paying customer, just FYI.
Yeah. So we started out really marketing to engineers, right? So people who wanted to build apps to send, say, SMS, right? And what we've grown into is this CPaaS or customer service platform, really, where it's all about, so like when you order from Uber Eats or from DoorDash or whoever, and you get that text that says, like, hey, your Dasher is waiting for your order, right? If it sends it to you by SMS, there's a potential that's going through Twilio, right? Because they would use our API to abstract all that complexity. Tufa, yeah, exactly.
The thing that I've been wanting, and I've been paying for a Twilio number for years because I generated a number and it's like $1 a year.
He's like, thank you.
It's like, yeah, like you can keep the phone number for a year and it was like an LA, a 323 number. And it was a good, I don't remember what the number was. I'd have to look it up now, but I'm just like every year, I'm like, yeah, I'll pay the dollar. I'll keep it. It's like a domain name basically.
Yeah, exactly.
I love how engineers just collect domains
and like so many
phone numbers.
Name's got all the good ones, right?
Yeah.
But the thing I've been wanting forever from Twilio is iMessage or RCS support. And I know you can't talk about roadmaps or anything like that, but like I ended up going to another one, SendBlue. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure they're built on top of Twilio and they implemented the like iMessage stuff on top of like the base number handling. But like it does iMessage properly. And so I was like, always like, well, I want like RCS. Like I just want like straight, like now that Apple's iOS supports RCS too. I'm like, how do I get a good like number RCS interaction that's a little more portable than iMessage?
Yeah, totally. I can send you some docs on RCS stuff. So
is it working now? Yeah. The last time I looked at it was last year.
Yeah, so. I'll send you some stuff.
Sweet. Man, now I got another project. I got to finish that project I shelved a year ago. Cool. But we wanted to talk about Hackyderm. You are part of the infrastructure team at hackyderm.io, which is one of the largest Mastodon instances that I know of. I know there are some big ones out there. I mean, obviously, like Mastodon Social, I think, is the largest still.
Yep.
By probably orders of magnitude.
I'm on your server.
You're on Hackyderm?
Yeah.
And so I want to talk about, like, you've had that for a little while now. I know Chris Nova and friends started it, and it's been going for a long time. And one of the things I loved about how you're running it is how open you are with the data. And you're like, this is how this works, and this is how the metrics are, and this is how we scale it, and this is all that stuff is really cool to see from, like, the outside. I'm like, oh, cool. I don't have to run it to see your dashboards.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I was super fortunate to cross paths with Chris while she was with us, while I was at Twilio, probably about like 2 years ago now, right, when there was the large Twitter exodus, right?
One of the first waves.
I know, it seems to be like another one every 6 months.
Yeah, we're on like wave like seven now or something like that. But yeah, Chris had started Hackyderm, literally running it out of her basement. There was an old Dell PowerEdge named Alice. That got us through like the first days of Hackyderm. And then we realized with that really big wave from Twitter, I think we went from something like 500 people to, I think we had a peak of like 36,000 over the course of like a handful of weeks. So, you know, ridiculous growth, right? Which kind of prompted us to say, hey, we've actually got to get out of the basement and build some proper infrastructure, right? So like I said, I crossed paths with Chris and she was like, hey, you want to come help out? And you know, the rest has kind of been history. So it's been fun riding the growth waves, especially, you know, using purely open source software, purely decentralized software like Mastodon is. And yeah, just really learning it and how it scales and, you know, building our infra and tuning it to serve the folks that are on it today.
She was so cool watching her do like the different, she would do kind of like, I don't know if it would be an AMA, but she would talk about the different infrastructure and how she was building it and all that. That was the coolest part about Mastodon, just the different ways that she would be so open and talk about the different like servers that she was using. And like, she would talk about how she's going to like do maintenance or, you know, all that cool stuff. And it was really cool that she would like
just live stream it. She was just like, I'm just going to, I got some stuff to do. Let me jump on in front of a camera and we're going to talk through it.
That was the best part of Mastodon. That's probably like the only like few things that like I would look forward to on there. Mm.
Yeah.
So how has that, like Mastodon as, and you're using the like official Mastodon instance, right? Because like there are forks, there are other options. I used one for a little while that Cloudflare wrote, Wildebeest, which was all like integrated into their workers and stuff like that. And I thought it was really cool because it was like a quote unquote serverless Mastodon, but it was like extremely difficult to upgrade and to change things. But you're using like the official Mastodon software, which is a Ruby on Rails app with like a Postgres database, right?
Yep,
like,
you got it. That's kind of the core. Yep.
Yeah. And if anyone has ever run Ruby on Rails, you're going to deal with Sidekick, you're going to deal with PG Bouncer, things like that, or like the traditional ways of scaling, right? Can you describe that path of like, hey, we went from 500 users to over 30,000?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, what's awesome is you actually hit the main kind of actors in the ecosystem, right? So really like looking at it from bottoms up, right? We went from Alice, which was one server that was hosting everything. The plan was then to break things out, right? And like you said, Postgres kind of at the bottom as the database. What we ended up doing there is we purchased and we actually run Metal servers in Hetzner in Germany and their Frankfurt data center. So Postgres sits on that. So it's a Metal server. It's quite large, you know, plenty of spare capacity for growth, those sorts of things. There's supposed to be, and this is one of our big projects that we've got to go do, is build up our secondary replica, right? So that we've got some good failover, good redundancy there, but that's kind of at the bottom, right? And as you mentioned, you know, as we go up the stack, PG Bouncer, absolutely for connection pooling, and making sure that we're not overloading the database in that sense. There are a pair of Redises that do both like kind of ephemeral caching and a bit more like permanent type caching, and that helps speed up interactions, through the web server. As we go up from there, you mentioned Sidekick. Sidekick is really the heart of how all the decentralized stuff works. If you can imagine, at any point in time in the Fediverse, like so many events are happening, right? And you've got to both advertise events out as things are happening on your server, you've got to be able to pull events in that are happening in the world and process those in a reasonable amount of time, right? So lots of sidekick. So, a good amount of our time and energy and some of the server capacity goes just making sure those jobs are doing what they need to go do, right? And we've got a lot of different queues involved, a lot of parallelism involved there as well.
And I think that, at least from my understanding, that's like the core differences to me between something like Mastodon and something like Blue Sky, where all of the heavy lifting of how the world is interacting is on individual Mastodon instances, where every single one of them, I like a post, I send an update, I do something that needs to go tell all of my, anyone I follow on different servers, and then I need to hear from all of those other people on all the different servers. So like on a single server, it seems like it's pretty constrained. Like if everyone only followed Hackaderm people on Hackaderm, you're probably fine, right? Like you're not doing a lot of network traffic. You're not doing like, I can do internal processes to do that stuff. But once you start having dozens of other servers or lots of people following other people on other instances, that seems to cause a lot of extra stress on your instance.
Absolutely. Yeah. Federations where it gets fun, right? Because as you can imagine, like as that social graph grows, you've got to interact with increasingly more and more endpoints around the world, right? So like, and we've got some folks who have some really large followings. And what's fun is, sometimes that causes spikes, right? Like you can go look at Grafana, you can go look at our queue depths and see where certain events are happening just because there's so much of that kind of chat and back and forth happening.
I remember a long time ago, Twitter said they had a whole dedicated server rec for Justin Bieber.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Like, it was just like, it was like because of the architecture, whenever someone with a big following was sending out an update, it caused so much traffic, they just had to scale it up. And there's like, for a long time, they were on-prem, they had bare metal stuff. And it was just like, we have a rack for Justin Bieber. And that's just like his is like, wow, that was amazing just to think of that. Of like, okay, how often is he interacting? Like, it doesn't matter. It's just like, cause we want that to go out to the millions of people that want to see the thing he's saying. And then they come back and interact with it and all that stuff. And all of those jobs just have to process in some order. They have to coordinate and they have to resync and everything. Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the best stories, or I guess use cases in
data-driven applications.
Yes, designing data-intensive applications. They were talked about like when they had to split the architecture for really popular Twitter users versus like regular Twitter users. And it's amazing how much work and how different each user was.
Tim Banks on the show just a few months ago or whatever was talking about that with like the hot girl problem, right? Where it's like,
well, he was talking about the Tinder version, which is wild because like we think of, it's even just funnier because people use travel mode so much, you know what I mean? And like just moving from place to place, like who would have thought that would be a whole different reason that you had to change architecture? Like, you know, like it's crazy the way that we've changed the way that we use the internet and interact with different applications and applications for different things and how that causes different architecture.
Am I the only one who like, I'll go download an app or I'll go to websites and like something slow or something acts weird. And I try to figure out what the architecture behind it is. Cause I feel like a lot of times I'm like, oh, I bet this is like a sidekick problem, right? Like they're trying to scale up something. Like there's a queue.
Trying to diagnose random apps.
I totally do it. I'm just like, I bet this is like a queuing problem somewhere that someone is like, ah, oh, you just didn't scale up this portion of it or, retries or something like that.
Yeah. Let's see. So other stuff in the architecture. So Mastodon Web is a Puma application. So in our ecosystem, we only have one instance of that. And again, that's another little mini project that we've got is to build some redundancy in there, and a scale point there. And then the last edge for us is our CD, what we call our CDN edge. It's something we're hosting in Linode or Linode, I guess, depending on how you like to say that. And we've got points of presence across the world, just for caching, for speed.
Linode got bought by Akamai, right?
They did, yes, yeah. So I'm still stuck on the old name.
Oh, I'm pretty sure the branding still stays of like they have like Linode by Akamai or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have those points of presence, so like kind of West, East U.S., Europe, Japan, and occasionally light those up.
At what point did you feel like you had to have a CDN?
So actually, when we did the move from Alice, from the basement into kind of our current architecture, we implemented it then, right? And actually, a big part of it was a lot of the traffic involved in Mastodon is media files, right? So images, movies, audio, whatever, right? And the stress that it put on just like the core server, even with caching, to provide that better experience, like we were like, okay, we've got to do CDN. We have to have something that's closer to our folks, and that's distributing that cache to take the load off the core server. So that was already in the architecture there.
If I remember correctly, when it was on Alice, the limiting, there was NFS for that storage, right?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay. So there was NFS on the back end that was storing that. Where is that stored now? Because that's a lot of just data, because it's on a CDN, but you got like, what, hundreds of gigs maybe that are coming in? And
terabytes easily, right? Yeah. So so that's all in DigitalOcean now. So we're using their Spaces product.
That's right.
S3 compatible API.
Not to distract from like where this is going, but like, how do you guys fund this?
That is a super great question. So we were super fortunate in that when throughout the lifetime of Hackaderm, right? We are part of what we call the Nivenly Foundation, which is an open source nonprofit foundation that Chris founded again about 2 years ago. I'm a member of the board there. And that's kind of like the umbrella organization. And we have folks who are kind enough to contribute to us, believe in the mission. And part of those contributions go to Hackaderm as well. So we have people who are directly contributing to Hackaderm. We have people who are contributing to Nivenly. And that's where that comes from.
What does Nivenly do outside of Hackaderm?
Yeah, totally. So Nivenly, we're all about, this is a lot of Chris's vision was building a foundation that could help open source projects really identify what we call pattern of patterns. So how do we start new open source projects? How do we fund them? How do we help them self-govern, right? So that the contributors, the maintainers of those open source projects can retain control, right? And direction and vision for their individual projects. So really about teaching and finding different unique ways that we can support them. So again, open source contributors can go do the open source thing, right? And the dream would really be able to support them in such a way that maybe they don't have to have their normal day job.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, totally. And we've got a couple projects under that right now. So Hackaderm being one of them.
I know Nivenly's been around for a little while, and Chris and I were talking about it like back in the day. Are you open about the like funding for that? Because I know there's donation side of it, and some of it is like actual, like I pay dollars for it, and there's some of like sponsorship, like DigitalOcean is sponsoring the object storage for Hackaderm. Do you break out the like where the spend goes? Like, is there like a line item that says like Hackaderm costs us this much money?
Yeah. So funny enough, I'm the treasurer for Nivenly.
Great.
So yes. So we do track all that on the backside. We have not, or I will actually even say, I have not done a good job of publishing that regularly. But our intent is to publish that on a quarterly basis and be fully transparent about, what are the types of in-kind donations are we getting? What are the types of membership donations that we're getting? And then, yeah, where do those costs break down?
Mm-hmm. So how much does Hackaderm cost?
So Hackaderm right now probably runs us just over $600 a month. So the vast majority of that spend goes towards media storage.
Well, that media storage, the CDN portion, right? Because the DigitalOcean side is sponsored, right?
It actually isn't. So right now we're getting like a little bit of a discount. So yeah, DigitalOcean, if you're listening, would like to sponsor, we'd be happy to talk. But yeah, no, that all comes out of Hackaderm spending. Yeah.
So did you guys buy the hardware upfront with like donations?
Yeah, so we're actually leasing that through Hetzner. So Hetzner has incredibly reasonable pricing, both for metal and their cloud products.
Who'd have thought?
We lease a few servers from them, that's how we're operating today. So we actually don't own any of the hardware at this point.
I didn't even know that they had a cloud. Like, I knew that they did leasing for like bare metal, but that's really interesting.
Yeah, totally. And that's actually like one of the interesting quirks or maybe features of Hackaderm, right? Is like, as we talk through the stack there, all these pieces are in different clouds, right? We explicitly chose not to go with, one of the larger clouds and put all our eggs in one basket. With the idea being that, because again, the Mastodon footprint is relatively straightforward and simple. Simple is probably the wrong word, but like
simple if you're familiar with Rails, right?
Like exactly. So there's effectively one application that we're hosting. We said, hey, we are going to go multi-cloud so that in the event that we have an issue with one of them, we can easily flip that piece that's being hosted there elsewhere, right?
What's up, friends? I'm here with a good friend of mine, Adam Jacob, co-founder and CEO of System Initiative. And I'm pretty excited to have him here because that means System Initiative is out there, is GA. Adam, I heard that you launched something.
Yeah. Oh, I'm stoked. We did. Yeah, we launched something on the 25th of September. And yeah, you can use System Initiative now by going to a website and signing up, and three clicks and you're in. And then you can automate infrastructure. It's sick. It's the coolest thing in the universe. I'm so proud of it.
Well, let's level some folks up. Let's level up the Terraform folks, the Pulumi folks, the AWS CDK folks. As of System Initiative being GA, these folks are kind of doing things the old way, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I hope is true.
Okay.
I think, yeah. Look, here's what it is. Basically, we figured out that part of the reason that it's so hard for us to achieve the outcomes we're looking to achieve with the kind of DevOps and operational work that we do is because the tools we're using sort of help bring about those tough outcomes. It's a lot harder to like write static code, have your friends review it. In System Initiative, what you do is you use this like living architecture diagram to put together all the different relationships between the things that you use. And then you can program that architecture diagram to do all the stuff you need it to do. So like it automatically understands how to do things like, you know, create resources and delete them or update their tags or do those things. But then you can also extend it with your own custom policy. And the whole thing happens in real time in multiplayer. Let's say you're going to like build some infrastructure. You got to go, you know, use an AWS account. You're going to launch a new service. So you got to go set up all the different pieces, the VPCs and the EKS clusters and, you know, ECS and database services. And you got to set up IAM rules. There's all this stuff you got to do. With System Initiative, what'll happen is you'll sign up, you'll get into this workspace, and then you'll have this list of all the different architecture assets that AWS provides. And what you'll do is throw those things into this big diagram in the center of the screen, which is basically this living architecture diagram. And then you'll connect them together, just like you would if you were drawing an architecture. And what it's doing when you do that is actually writing the code to describe how these things work. And it's running it as a simulation. So it's telling you in real time, this would work or this wouldn't. So you don't have to wait. There's no like long feedback loops. We can actually vet all of that infrastructure and all that architecture in advance. Then you can say, hey, this looks good. It's what I want to see in the real world. And you can apply that change set. And it's keeping track of all the different things you have to do to actually go make that infrastructure real. And then it goes and does it. And then after it does, it keeps track of those things too. So you can see both sides. You can see the real thing in the world that is what you created, and it's attached to the model of what you thought you wanted. And then you can use that to manage it over time. And then when you have customizations or tweaks or things you need to build for yourself, you can go write that directly into the system in real time in these same kind of change sets that you use to do the infrastructure. And so that's what it's like to use System Initiative. It's the most powerful, intuitive, collaborative way to do this work that's ever existed.
Okay, System Initiative is out there. It is GA and it's the future. Go to systeminit.com. Get started in three clicks. They do have a free tier that means free. No credit card required that you can play with. Again, systeminit.com. That's systeminit.com.
How big is the team that manages Hecator?
It's a rotating cast of folks. We've got some core folks, probably like four or five core folks who are around, and then you know volunteers who kind of come and go. So what's nice about the infrastructure that we've set up so far is that it's relatively stable, right? Probably the main stressors that would cause it to become meta stable would be maybe like another Twitter exodus, right? Like another big surge of growth. But even with that, we've kind of planned for the future. We have got spare capacity and kind of like the key scale points right now. So yeah, largely the software, it just kind of runs, right? And like the big activities end up being stuff like major upgrades, right? So version bumps from Mastodon upstream. So we just did 4.3.0 last week, which is probably our biggest upgrade that we've done in a while. And then we did 4.3.1, which was basically a non-event because it was super simple. But generally, upgrade like the hard upgrades are upgrades that involve database migrations, right? Yeah.
Those are always the hard ones.
Yeah, exactly. It's just because you're touching the real data, right? And there's always a little bit of fear there, but you know we've got some good mitigations in case.
Is it still rake?
Yeah. So yeah. So it's just core Rails stuff, right? So
rake migrate DB. Okay, cool.
Yeah, and there you go.
Has the Redis licensing affected the way that Hecator runs at all?
So it hasn't, but we have had conversations about moving to something that is like truly open source. And kind of in the same vein, Terraform going to the BSL license. We've talked about OpenTofu. Actually, at this point, I forget which version of Terraform it is, but we pinned to the very last version of Terraform that was the open source license. And then again, at some point, another mini project could be, let's go open Tofu, right?
You have multiple clouds, which Terraform is just great at. It's just like, hey, we'll make this look like one thing, basically. But then you only have a few servers in Hetzner. And how are you actually deploying that? Is it like Terraform, create my server, manage my server, and then like Ansible provision the application? Is it like a Kubernetes cluster on those servers? What are you doing?
So less glorious than that. So we actually, again, another key infrastructure decision that we made pretty early on was no Kubernetes, right? Because we wanted to avoid the complexity that introduces. And again, don't get me wrong, I use Kubernetes all day at day job, right? But for this, we made a key decision. We're like, hey, it adds layers of indirection, right? Especially when we think about the network and the abstractions that you have to deal with through Kube API. And we said, hey, we're going to treat this just like a simple application, right? So, and right now, I will be super honest, deployments are pretty manual, right? So it's SSH in, go do the thing, right? We've done some light Ansible work around provisioning, kind of the post-provisioning after host boots. But yeah, for the most part, it's actually manual, right? So with like the core infra around the hosts themselves being terraformed.
Yeah. You're like, I get an IP address and I'm going to go do the thing as an admin that I know how to do. And I think that's like a lot of people overemphasize everything needs to be automated. I'm like, no. I was like, I've run a lot of infrastructure in a lot of places, and having manual steps is actually really important for some things.
Yeah, totally. And like there are certain runbooks for activities that happen a lot, right? So again, Mastodon upgrade, there's a standard script that we run every single time we do a Mastodon upgrade. And it's relatively, like, it's not that it's unattended. It's just very automated, and a human watches it. And when it's done, right? And yeah, maybe an upgrade takes, again, without a database migration, maybe an upgrade takes 30 minutes, right? Even when we did the 4.3.0 upgrade, I think that we did that over the course of like maybe 2 hours. And again, largely uneventful, pretty straightforward. It just involved a database migration that took a little bit longer.
Do you guys have like a team of people that get paged for Mastodon?
We actually don't. So the way that we've got it set up right now is we've got an uptime robot that will watch, kind of do our synthetic checks, right, to our public facing properties. That'll alert into Discord. We've got folks kind of around the world, and we've got an infra channel. If somebody sees something, they will go do something, right? So nothing as fancy as actually getting paged.
I'm on the like infrastructure team for Southern California Linux Expo, and like we have a Slack channel that has a page, or not PagerDuty, Datadog, that's like, hey, guess what, the site's down. And like someone's like, oh, I'm on, I'll check it.
It's just, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And then from like to kind of continue the observability stack, again, another mini project coming up here in a second. So we've got Grafana. There's a public site to Grafana, so if you actually want to look at our public dashboards, if you just go to grafana.hackaderm.io, you can see the public dashboard that kind of has like the key vitals, right? Not quite at the level of like SLO, more like an SLI, where we're looking at like very specific health attributes of the different services that we provide.
That requires a login.
I might have to send you the public dashboard specifically. Okay. Yeah, it's probably.
I was gonna put it in the notes, but yeah.
Yeah. I'll send it to you afterward. Right. But yeah, you can look at like kind of the key metrics. And again, like we talked about Sidekick earlier, that's probably like one of the main things that we watch is like, how hot are the Sidekick queues? Are they getting super deep? Are they getting backed up for some reason?
What if it gets stuck and you have to kick it?
you gotta do something, right? So so Grafana kind of has like that main visualization layer backed by Prometheus for metrics. We're manually registering servers there, for scrapes and things like that. Not too long ago, we set up Loki and Promtail to scrape logs and ship those central. So they're available in Grafana as well. And what else from observability? Oh, the mini project that's coming up is in Mastodon 4.3.0, there's finally support for OpenTelemetry. So next little mini project is, get OTel Collector spun up and start presenting that, which is actually going to be pretty important because as of 4.3.0, they also deprecated the statsd, permission.
We just had Austin Parker on the show, who's on the OTel board, which was a really fun conversation. So yeah.
Awesome. Super cool. Yeah. So that's going to be a fun little mini project. That might be something I'd like to try to do this weekend or something. So yeah, totally.
You said you've been going through these waves of like people leaving everything. And like you went from that 500 to over 30,000. How many active users are on it today?
So I think the last time I checked, monthly active users was somewhere around 11 to 12,000. So, that's still a lot of folks. So I think total accounts was something like 55,000. That's on the public dashboard as well. I think monthly active was like 11 or so.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, it's been running okay, you've scaled up the things that tip, like the Redis queues and the PG bouncers. Are there other areas that you think like this is the next thing that's going to fall over? If you get to 100,000 users or 30,000 active monthly, like what's the next thing that's going to break?
Yeah, totally. I think insofar as just like scaling, like again, it's probably Sidekick, right? Where there's probably good opportunity for us to do a bit better about maybe like reactive auto scaling even with Sidekick, where it's like, hey, we have a predefined threshold where we go spin up another maybe machine that goes and runs X number of Sidekick queues, right, or replicas to go handle load whenever we're a certain percentage behind or a certain percentage deep in the queues. That generally tends to be the thing that gets stressed the most. That's where we see things get hot. The web side, you know, I mentioned earlier there's a project to go, you know, put some redundancy there. That's more from like a redundancy and a failure mitigation perspective, and less from like a scale or a stress point. It actually tends to do pretty okay. And then, I mean, I'm always afraid of the database, right? Just because the data is the data, right? So I think there's some good opportunities there. Again, less from like a scaling perspective, because Postgres does like a freaking awesome job of just like running so well. So it'd be more, again, from like a read replica perspective, maybe offload a little bit from the primary, but more from like a, hey, if the big database goes down, do we have a place to flip quickly without having to restore from backup, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
How many backups do you have currently?
So right now we do a weekly full backup. I think we're keeping those for, I'll have to go double check how long we're keeping the full backup for 3 weeks at a time, 21 days. And then we do a daily incremental diff. So we're actually in a pretty good position from a backup perspective.
That is actually really good, especially for this, how small your team is and the money you're spending per month.
Exactly. Well, and like for us too, it's like we can have that small team and, you know, have some solace in the fact that like, hey, if something really, really bad happened, like let's say all the disks for whatever failed on like that primary, we can get back and, you know, have a reasonable, you know, kind of like RPO, RTO, right?
I think it's also because you have like a very talented team. I don't know if it could be run the same with the amount of people you have if you guys didn't have so much experience.
Absolutely. Like, don't get me wrong. Like the folks that we had, you know, building the initial architecture to get us here that actually executed on it, the folks that have been helping us over the years, you know, even the folks who have just showed up for like a month or two, done a little bit and then gone and done the next thing, like everybody's been amazing, right? And we absolutely wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be able to run this without those folks.
Well, you're one of the talented people too, but
I try to help, you know. you know, just think about other scale points again. Like, I just always come back to Sidekick, right? Because that is, again, as the Fediverse graph grows, that's the thing that gets really, really stressed.
Has Sidekick and databases been the most painful part of your infrastructure?
Yes. Like, yes, period.
Yeah.
I mean, like Redis is pretty commonly known and just like kind of works. And then Puma is like, yeah, no, Puma's fine.
It's there. Yeah, it's, exactly. Yeah. Like generally, like when I think back to like, you know, incidents that we've had or challenges that we've had or like the scary moments that we've had, it's generally been, yeah, Sidekick queues are way backed up. What's up? Right. And then, you know, really figuring out like the tuning. Hazel Weekly did a lot of really great work around tuning of those queues, you know, parallelism, number of queues, where they're actually deployed, that sort of stuff. And then the database, right? It's just like
the Postgres.
Yeah, for Postgres. Yeah. And then it was essentially just, let's give it a lot of power, a lot of CPU, a lot of memory, fast disks, and let's over provision so that we know it's ready for it.
Which is interesting too, because like that, the vertical scaling side of it's when you're using a metal server is just so much more cost efficient than like, oh, let me scale up this EC2 instance, which is like my cost is going to go up four times.
But that's hard with relational databases because they take so much like CPU.
They'll take what you give them.
Yeah,
you give them,
right? You know what I
mean?
Yeah,
exactly.
So it's like everybody's like, we can just do everything on Postgres, which Postgres is a beast. But like there, I think we're also going to learn why we have non-relational databases or NoSQL databases, because everyone's like, just put everything in it. And I'm like, I think you forgot the scaling problems that people have on a like relational database. But Postgres is like the goat and everything runs on it though.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah. And like the other thing that we have to keep in mind is like, you know, because they're metal servers, if we want another one, right? If we say we're going to go add another server, that is a process that takes a week.
That's actually fast, though.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. That's fast from like Hetzner has been very responsive, very reactive from that perspective. But it's not hey, I go to EC2 and go do a run instances, and suddenly I've got another machine in a couple of minutes, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So there's we've got to have, you know, some pre-planning and foresight there. And again, it was just like, hey, let's go to Big Box.
Yeah. You mentioned Hazel, and we're going to have her on the show in a couple of weeks. But she and I were talking about just like the progression of that base infrastructure. And I thought one of the most fascinating things was when it was running off of Alice, one of the things that Chris kept getting calls from her ISP, like, you're doing a lot of traffic, right? Like, you yes. need to get a business plan, right? And so like that was part of the motivator of like, we can't run this big social network from someone's house.
Yeah, exactly. No, that was a big part of it. Transferring it to like a foundation as a part of just being in Nova's basement was a big part of it as well. And then, you know, also kind of starting to even think about things like data residency, right? And just thinking about the different legal jurisdictions that we operate in, where we have folks who have data. And it was like, okay, hey, we're going to move to the EU very specifically as a very specific choice. And Germany is a very specific choice, right? Because of the protections offered there and the strength of those laws.
I remember she posted a picture of Alice like in her basement, and it was so cool. It was like, it's like, you almost forget how much servers do for social media because just everything lives in your phone in the cloud, and to see a physical server and everybody like being connected on it was so cool.
And the fact that one physical server from someone's house could handle 500-ish people on like, here's my server, like this is fine, right? Like before the ISPs come knocking at the door, before you need anything like scaling out and you don't need PG Bouncer and all that other stuff, you're like, I have enough disk capacity with some NFS maybe to do this. It's not amazing, but it works. And you people underestimate, like, I want to go start a blog, I want to go do something, like, just go run it from your website or from your house. Like you have a public IP address. Like just, you can like DNS that, and like you can even rotate it, all that stuff. And you could just do it from your house and start without needing to like go pay for all this other stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And like one thing the Mastodon project has done really well, you know, I know I said we don't use Kubernetes or containerized Mastodon. They've done an excellent job of building this little micro ecosystem where, yeah, it like, yeah, if you run Kubernetes, like you can very easily just say, I want a Mastodon. And you go apply the deployment and you've got one, right? So which is super cool from like an approachability, you know, low barrier to entry perspective.
As long as you know Kubernetes.
As long as you know Kubernetes.
the bar is actually kind of high. Yes, same with Rails, right? Like if you know how to run a Rails app, then you're like, oh, this is all familiar. Like that was the whole point of Rails, is just to make it familiar to everyone. If you go from one Rails app to the other, like guess what? This is gonna scale the same way. And it's gonna be very familiar to debug it and to see what's going on.
Okay, but why do they use N so many times?
Why do they use what so many times?
For N? Ruby, when they do like end instead of the brackets, like it drives me nuts. Like, I just want to know like who did this and why are they
curly braces?
Me? Yes, that's
yeah, like, give me curly braces.
Because
yeah.
It just you close the braces like end. It's like you have to be over there counting ends. Like I've spent so many hours with a missing end. Like I have flashbacks. Like.
Yes. Yeah. I am not a Ruby person, but I've, you know, learned enough to be dangerous and to at least keep Mastodon running. So,
I mean, I would rather tune Sidekick than try to like dive into the JVM again. Right. Like the two big apps I've done in my life are JVMs or Ruby. And I'm like, nah, like give me Ruby.
I'll take the brackets and the structure because I hate unstructured.
You like sentence long functions? Yes. It's cool. You want a factory?
Okay, but
factory?
You know what it's, but we know like specifically what we're asking it to do. Okay. So what were some of the laws that made you pick the EU? Like what in Germany specifically, like what were some of the things that motivated you for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So GDPR obviously is probably like the big prevailing one, right? And again, like the type of data we have is really interesting, right? Because it's in a lot of ways, I'm not going to say it's PII in the sense that it's like, you know, personally identifiable
information. Sometimes it is.
But it could be, right? Like people could put interesting PII out there, but it's information that is very personal to the people who are posting it, right? Again, the intent was for us to be in a place where we could feel safe that you know, maybe the prevailing government or whatever wouldn't show up and be like, yo, Hackaderm, you're hosting this type of content, we're gonna shut you down.
Mastodon instances have gone down for that. That's not even like a theoretical, like, oh no, this maybe is happening. I was fascinated talking to Hazel about that, where it's like one of the reason that it's under Nivenly as a foundation is to protect the people that are doing the work, right? Because it's like, oh, you're the web admin on this thing. You're coming to court.
We're coming to you, right? Yeah, exactly. Especially in like a world where it's like, you know, DMCA takedown notices, you know, like think of just all the different legal ways that people can go after.
Can you describe why that's specifically an issue for something like Mastodon, where it's like, if I run a website, that's not a problem.
Sure. Like DMCA. Yeah.
No, I mean like just like the content, why is other people posting content on other servers a problem for you?
Sure. Yeah. So part of it is, you know, people can post whatever, right? So, and again, depending on the location of the server, depending on the authorities, the prevailing government though, and the type of content that's being posted, you know, we could be put in the crosshairs where, you know, the government would be like, hey, you're hosting this content that in our jurisdiction is illegal or offensive or whatever. You need to take care of it, right? Or, you know, we may block your site, or hey, we may go after your company or the individual, you know, the officers of your company, because again, you're potentially doing something illegal in our jurisdiction. So finding kind of that sweet spot, and again, like Germany was it when we did the move, was super important for us.
Seems like you put a lot of care and thought into it, which is cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like the intent was, you know, it started in Chris's basement. The intent is for this to be a thing that's around for a really long time, right? And again, like that's where the technical architecture, the legal architecture, even though we're not lawyers, you know, we spent that energy putting all that thought in there because we wanted to be around, you know, in 5, 10, however many years.
Okay, friends, I'm here with a new friend of ours over at Timescale, Avthar Suwathan. So Avthar, help me understand, what exactly is Timescale?
So Timescale is a Postgres company. We build tools in the cloud and in the open source ecosystem that allow developers to do more with Postgres. So using it for things like time series analytics, and more recently, AI applications like RAG and search and agents.
Okay, if our listeners were trying to get started with Postgres, Timescale, AI application development, what would you tell them? What's a good roadmap?
If you're a developer out there, you're either getting tasked with building an AI application, or you're interested and you're seeing all the innovation going on in the space and want to get involved yourself. And the good news is that any developer today can become an AI engineer using tools that they already know and love. And so the work that we've been doing at Timescale with the PG AI project is allowing developers to build AI applications with the tools and with the database that they already know, and that being Postgres. What this means is that you can actually level up your career, you can build new interesting projects, you can add more skills without learning a whole new set of technologies. And the best part is, it's all open source. Both PG AI and PG Vector Scale are open source. You can go and spin it up on your local machine via Docker, follow one of the tutorials on the Timescale blog, build these cutting edge applications like RAG and search without having to learn 10 different new technologies, and just using Postgres and the SQL query language that you will probably already know and are familiar with. So yeah, that's it. Get started today. It's a PG AI project, and just go to any of the Timescale GitHub repos, either the PG AI one or the PG Vector Scale one, and follow one of the tutorials to get started with becoming an AI engineer just using Postgres.
Okay, just use Postgres, and just use Postgres to get started with AI development, build RAG, search, AI agents, and it's all open source. Go to timescale.com/AI, play with PG AI, play with PG Vector Scale, all locally on your desktop. It's open source. Once again, timescale.com/AI.
How do you go about, because like Mastodon also caches from other servers, like I follow some from another server and then I'm just going to get random content from that other server, even if I'm not following the person. And again, it's not even just your users, like your users you could kick out, right? Like someone like keeps posting something that's illegal, you're like, actually, you can't do that here, go somewhere else. And you can just ban them basically. But other people posting things on other servers, you can't ban the person over there. Is the only recourse to like block all access to that other server?
Yeah, so that's actually, so I'll say it two different ways. So it's something that Mastodon is doing well, but can continue to do better, right? Because they've actually started to build some good moderation tools where, like you said, like locally you can absolutely say like, hey, this member, you know, they're banned because they posted whatever they've offended the server rules or whatever. But you can actually also do that for people who are not on your server, right? So if somebody from mastodon.social is spamming, let's say, right, which actually happens very, very often, you can individually block that account, right? Even though they're on a remote server. If you find that the server as a whole, let's say like there's an unmoderated server or a server with questionable content or positions that don't agree with your kind of code of conduct, you can actually defederate from that server entirely, right? So that means anyone posting on that, any activity that's happening on there is no longer relayed through your server. And honestly, as much as we're talking about the infra here, to me, the real magic of Hackaderm is the moderation team.
And that's, I mean, every social network is the moderation. Like that's what the thing that is important.
Exactly. Like ultimately, like the network and the experience for the people on your network is only as good as your moderation team. And that's something where our folks have, again, spent a lot of time and thought and energy and just thinking about, okay, what does it mean to moderate? What does the moderation experience look like? What should that look like for for folks who are on Hackaderm or even off Hackaderm, right? Because there's always the potential that somebody joins Hackaderm and starts spamming from us, right? How are we on top of that? How are we treating people, with respect, but at the same time, making sure that we've got good boundaries so that we're keeping a healthy community, for our folks.
Because you mentioned that like relay blocking thing, that immediately to me sounds like what I would do with a pie hole, right? Where I'm like, I got this big host file where I'm just like, no, you don't reach any of that. Is that like a subscription? Like, is there known Mastodon servers that you subscribe to a black hole list of, we're not allowing that here?
Yeah, totally. And I think this is like a big evolution point for Mastodon, potentially like the Fediverse as a whole, is actually figuring that out, right? So there are a number of services or organizations that do provide things like that, right? Where you can say, okay, I want to subscribe into a defederation list, and again, like this is actually a really big active debate that's going on in the community right now is, should they be allow lists? Should they be deny lists that you're subscribing to? How do the subscriptions work both on a technical or a social level? So yes, you can, right? And again, depending on how your moderators like to run your servers, some people do, some people don't. And right now, it's not something that's built into like the core, like subscribing to defederation lists is something that's built into Mastodon core right now.
Not at ActivityPub.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, so like Mastodon as like the upstream Mastodon project.
Yeah, because I know other Mastodon servers that don't have those features and they don't even do relays, right? Like it's like a super lightweight, like I can run this for myself. I don't do a lot of the things that are really heavy about a Mastodon server. I don't do it and it's fine. And you don't have to do those things, but the actual like subscription, let's make sure that this works across services is mainly just for the upstream Mastodon server. Official. I don't know if it's, I guess it's official. It's the one at Mastodon.social.
Yeah.
How does this relate to Threads? Right? Like Threads is peering with ActivityPub, Tumblr is starting to do that. Are you seeing any uptick in traffic or new places you have to scale or block or moderate? Because there's these, Facebook has a lot more infrastructure than you do. and they can just throw more money and more servers at the problem to say like, well, you know what, like Sidekick, you just get a whole data center. I don't care.
Yeah, exactly,
like,
exactly.
It doesn't matter to us. How are you, like, is that causing extra stress on your instances?
Yeah, so far, no. Right now, that being said, particularly like with Threads, and again, I'm actually not super familiar with like their internal infrastructure, like how they're set up, but they're starting to engage in limited federation.
They're very piecemeal about how they're like, we want this feature from this thing and make you feel warm and fuzzy that we have activity.
Exactly. Yeah. And so like super early on when Threads first announced like, hey, we're going to federate into the Fediverse, big conversation, big controversy about, should servers even allow that, right? Is it okay for Meta to start to push things into the Fediverse? So big discussion there. From a technical perspective, yeah, like just like you were saying, Justin, like the concern is, okay, well, what if they turn it on for literally everybody?
You would just blow
and
you
it just
the water,
destroys like, yeah. Yeah, exactly, the Fediverse. And some people thinking like, hey, that's the plan, right? Is like that's how they're going to destroy the Fediverse and take it over, right? Or but yeah, to this point so far, again, because I think they've taken kind of this limited measured approach to federation. We haven't seen anything, you know, from like a Sidekick perspective or you know, just a general scale perspective that's broken anything at this point. Now, is that going to change in the future? I don't know, but so far, so good.
I heard a recent podcast with whoever's running Threads over there, and they were asking, like, are you ever going to turn on by default Fediverse interaction? He's like, absolutely not. Like, we're never enabling that by default. And immediately you're like, okay, cool. We're never going to get more than like, we're never going to get double digit percentage of Threads users to like go find the obscure setting to say like, yeah, federate all my stuff across all of ActivityPub all the time. Like, it's just not going to happen because it's not going to be there by default. And they have no incentive to do that because they're the ones selling the ads.
I don't think most people even know that it exists half
the time. And that's the point, right? Like, there's just like, it's a feature to get the nerds on board.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah. And like you mentioned ads, like that was a big concern again with the federation model is like, okay, well, is Meta going to start trying to push ads through federation? And then, you know, I'm on Hackaderm and I see an ad for something. So again, to this point, haven't seen that. You know, obviously, like as the situation evolves, you know, we might change our stance.
I never really thought about how that might work because by default, it's only users that are doing the inbox outbox sort of handshake between instances. But is there other metadata that gets sent that they could try to like push content to you to say like, this is.
Yeah. So like, depending on the scope that you're looking at. So like normally when you log into like the Mastodon, you're seeing your kind of feed, right? It's like, okay, who are the people in hashtags that I'm looking to, or I'm listening to, or I'm watching. You can actually change scopes to look at like, what is happening in the Fediverse, right? For all the things that your servers relate to. So like in that case, like they could push a post, right? They could have a user, a quote unquote user that could push a post that's an ad, right? It happens to come from threads.net. And it shows up in kind of that global Fediverse view, right? So that could be one way.
You just have to trust them at that point too, because they could say this post has 1 million likes and you have no way to verify or do anything around like, oh yeah, obviously that's the most popular thing in the world right now. We should show it to more people.
Yeah. Well, and so, and with the way that Mastodon works right now, there is no algorithm, right? In the sense that like things aren't weighted. You know, there are things like trending hashtags that might show, but like in terms of like your feed and your posts, it's linear. It's like what, you know, first in, first out, right? So. But yeah, if they say it has 1 billion likes, you know, that's what the ActivityPub message said. So it must, right?
And I guess they could also just like send you a bunch of posts that have a hashtag to get that in trending, right? Just like, totally. Even if you're not showing this to people, here's a bunch of stuff and you have no way to like verify it. You don't have any way because it's their infrastructure sending stuff to you. And you're just like, all right.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about the federation model, right? Or just really just the Fediverse in general, right? Is like in the end, it becomes a web of trust, right? And it's like, do you trust these other servers to send you things that you want your people to see?
It's a web of trust and it's affecting your site, which is the weird thing, right? Because like my blog, my web ring, again, back all the way. My web ring, like I trusted those people because I was reading their content for a while, but anything they posted didn't actually affect me, right? Like it didn't show up on my site. And I haven't had comments on my websites for a long, long time, because I don't want your stuff showing up here. Like if I want to hear your opinion, I'm going to go out to social media. I'm going to find the opinion out there, but I don't want it muddying the water of like, someone just read this, you know, even like YouTube comments, right? Like I'm glad they hide most of them by default now, because most of them are like, this is trash or whatever. It's just like, oh, so it's going to like taint someone else's view of like, did I just read something good? Did I watch something I liked? It doesn't matter. Cause someone else that was popular said, this sucks. And like, okay, well maybe 9 out of 10 comments say this sucks, so I'm the wrong one. It's like, it doesn't actually matter. So like I turn that stuff off on my sites, but it's fascinating that you now have to trust some other website to send you something that you can't verify, and it might affect how people see stuff that is not controlled by you, but is somehow aggregated and shown.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's where we're getting it goes back to moderation, having good moderation practices, consistent moderation practices.
Moderation's key in being able to block people.
Yeah, like absolutely, right? And it does, like, you know, content absolutely does affect reputation, right? If we take too long to take action on something, or potentially even if we take what's perceived as the wrong action, right? People might say, oh, well, Hackaderm moderation, y'all aren't doing it right.
And I do find that interesting that the Mastodon model of moderation is the server, basically. Like there is individual block lists, but eventually you have to land on a community server that is well run, that you trust the moderators are doing things in your best interests. And then if your only recourse, if that isn't the case, is to go find another community that you align with a little better. Mastodon doesn't have anything like Blue Sky has block lists that are individually maintained. That like someone's like, hey, these are harassers. These are people that I don't like. If I don't like a list of five people, you can subscribe to my block list and you can also not have those five people. But Mastodon doesn't have something like that at the individual level, right?
So at the individual level, I don't think so. I'd have to go double check. I know there are like scripts that will let people import them and kind of like do individual API requests to do blocks like that.
Twitter had a similar thing. Like you could subscribe to like a block bot or whatever, and it would automatically like it had access to your account by going in and saying like, okay, yeah, I'm going to block all those things that this other person also blocked.
Yeah. Yeah. At this point, like I know at the server level, there's not the notion of a block list that you could just say, hey, I want to go use Mastodon.social's block list or whatever like that. That doesn't exist. And again, there are multiple proposals for how to do that that are kind of flying around right now. And then, yeah, at an individual level, I don't think that exists. Again, I'd have to double check. Yeah. But to your point, like, yeah, if you find yourself in a community that's not, you know, aligning to what you want, you can use the migration feature to move. But obviously, that's a heavy toll, right? It's like,
well, and migration isn't bring your content,
right?
It's bring your metadata, bring your followers,
bring your identity and your followers, kind of.
And it's not even like bring your identity; it's like redirect your identity.
Yeah, it's like, right? Oh, hey, redirect to over here, right?
Right. It's like I equate it to kind of like if I move my house. My new house is somewhere else and I can tell the post office forward my mail for 30 days. And it's like, hey, keep sending me this mail. If it comes here, it's actually for me. I don't want something. Please just do that for me. Do you see that happening a lot? Do you see people going between servers frequently?
Or? You know, it depends. I mean, like that's, again, like the fun part about the Fediverse is like the graph is always changing. Servers are coming and going. So I would say in general, yes. Like we do see that happening a lot.
And that was one of my fears of like these servers get shut down because they're either too expensive, legal reasons, people aren't interested in running them, and whatever reason. And that's like my post office shutting down when I told them to forward my mail, right? Like now, like that post office doesn't exist anymore. Nobody has that rule to forward your mail. Sorry, like you're just a new person.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, oh, hey, X site is offline. Like that domain name doesn't respond anymore, right? So there's nothing there. Right.
Immediately, I thought you meant like X, the site x.com.
Oh, yes.
Like,
oh, sorry.
I was like,
yes.
Is X down again? No, I was like, oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I meant that as generic domain.
Yeah. If X is down, you get more users on your site.
So. Yes. I keep forgetting that that's the domain now.
I still call it Twitter.
I do too.
I call it Twitter when I want to talk about features that I liked.
That's awesome.
X is like the derogatory term.
Yep.
It is scary to lose all your like content on Mastodon.
There is an export feature that can give you your content, right? Like it gives you a zip similar to what, I mean, because like people forget that like X has that and Facebook has that. And this came out from what was it called? Google Plus? No, what was it? Yeah, Google Plus.
The Waves.
Is that what it's called?
I forget.
Yeah. Like it was the social network. There was like this huge legal battle that like people had to allow you to export your content. Mm. And it was like all these big social networks had this. It was called Takeout. That's what it's called. Google Takeouts. They were like the driver of this because they're like, we want people to move to Google Plus. And so we're going to make this like legal battle to make Facebook do it. We're going to make Twitter do it. We're going to make Instagram do it. Wow. And so you can go to all those sites and there's a legal reason, at least in the United States. I don't know about the rest of the world, but you can go download your content and they give you a zip. And like the Twitter export. Right. If you export your data, you get like a little mini website and it shows you like your stuff, like all in the thing. And the idea was that you could then go somewhere else and you would import that into another social network. It's like, hey, here's all my stuff. Please import this for me like it was yours. And I know there was some like projects that started up around that would be like, oh, we're going to take your Twitter and put it in Tumblr. And we're going to do those sorts of things. But like it never really caught on really large. And then Google got bored and they turned off Google Plus and all the stuff that normally happens.
I might go export my Twitter feed.
I deleted all of my Twitter and I kept an export. So like I have an export.
Can you mass delete your Twitter without deleting?
Not anymore because the API limits, you used to be able to. So I did it before the API limits came out. And so you can pay for a service to mass delete your X posts. Because they're like, we will pay to get more API quota for you. There's also some like free scripts you can run that'll be like, hey, delete my last 2000. And then you like, the next week you have to run it again
over the next day.
Yeah. Now that I've moved so much over to Blue Sky, I think I might just mass delete my Twitter because just the shady things that man is doing. Like, did you see the thing today about how he says he talks to Putin like every like all the time, like the amount of data that he has on all of us. And
yeah, I deleted 16 years of content. I was like, I was on that site, I really enjoyed it, and I was just like, nope, not doing it. Like, it's just, I have to get out. And
so, I just don't want to contribute to the data and to the things that he's doing that are wrong, especially after just seeing like how much icky stuff shows up from my like business account that follows nobody. Like, it's just very clear where we're going.
I am still waiting to shut down my business account. I've brought it up so many, like, I run it, the X, like my company's X account. I'm like, as soon as we get more followers somewhere else, I'm just shutting this down. Like, I don't want it here. I don't want it here.
Yeah. As soon as my Blue Sky like started to outpace Twitter, I was like, there's just no, it's icky. I don't want it anymore.
Done. Let's go. Yeah. Like, one thing that brings up, like, going back to like, you know, largest cost for Hackaderm is journalist storage, right? And it's media storage. Right. So like one thing we'll have to figure out probably sometime soon is, you know, what's the cost of infinite, you know, unbounded storage, right? If we just keep everything forever, we wouldn't be able to run Hackaderm, right? So at some point, you know, what does archiving look like? And then what's the user experience impact? It's like, okay, if I wanted to go export 16 years of Hackaderm history, do I lose the first 14 years of images and things that I posted?
That's true.
Yeah, that would make me sad.
Yeah, exactly. So, but then at the same time, it's like, we can't keep that stuff forever, because then, you know, we'll be paying $10,000 a year on S3 storage or whatever, you know.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Like, as you want it to live for a long, long time, and that storage isn't going to get less, and it's not going to.
Yeah, it's like, what's that balance, right?
I mean, there's definitely a balance of like, how much do you keep in a CDN? But there's still a balance of like that hot, warm, cold sort of storage tiers. Are there any other like long-term risks, you think?
Other long-term risk? I mean, like, that's from like a customer experience perspective, I think that's, or a consumer experience perspective, I think that's probably like the main one, right? It's just like, yeah, the cost of storage just keep going up. Other like big stuff could be, you know, political jurisdiction, legal jurisdiction type stuff changing. That's always a thing. Those are, to me, like, those would be the big ones, right? But I think insofar as like just like core infrastructure, it's like, no, we can run this thing for a while. Always looking for volunteers. Again, like I said, like, even if it's like you're going to rotate in for a couple weeks and do, you know, little project here or there, you know, always happy to have folks come help out.
I frequently recommend people that like, I want to get into technology. I want to do infrastructure. I don't have any experience. I'm like, go find an open source project like Hackaderm. Help out. The absolute, like I send people to the Fedora project, the Kubernetes project. I've sent people over to Hackaderm. I'm like, if you want to know how this stuff runs, there are people in Discord that will literally just sit with you, let you watch them do some work, and then hand over the keys and say, hey, let's do this together. And then you're going to get like actual professional resume experience that you're like, I helped with this project scaling, whatever reason. So if you're trying to get into this space, there are open source projects. There are foundations like Nivendly that create and run infrastructure on the public internets that will be beneficial for you to understand, and you can get it for free. Just spend your time there.
It's a great learning experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, if you want to do Linux sysadmin work, you know, Postgres work, Ruby on Rails scaling, distributed system scaling, like, yeah, come on, y'all. Yeah,
I see it so often on LinkedIn, Reddit, wherever. People are like, how do I get into infrastructure with no experience? I'm like, go find some experience. Like, you can do it at your home lab, that's fine. But like, go, open source projects are asking for help.
Absolutely.
And you can go help out. You can go say, I'm going to show up here once a week, twice a week, whatever time you have. And they're like, great, here's some docs. Let us know where there's problems in the docs. Like, even that's helpful in so many cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even just documentation work.
If I move out of engineering, I think you'll definitely join one of the Kubernetes release teams just to like not lose experience doing release and infrastructure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Man, the Kubernetes, I was on a release team before, and it's a lot. There's so many like sub projects that roll up into this thing. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So Preston, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for talking to us about all about Hackaderm. If people want to find you, what's your Hackaderm handle? Where should they?
So I am esk at hackaderm.io. I don't post a whole heck of a lot. And when I do, it's usually like synthesizer stuff. So
no one can see your background right now, but I was looking at all those synthesizers and wires back there. I'm like, that looks like fun. Like, I don't need another hobby.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fun hobby. It's kind of like my medium in between, doing like, I guess like real world engineering where I get to work with like electricity and stuff like that. And kind of blends it with creativity because I get to sometimes create music, usually create noise.
It's basically engineering too.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. No difference. Same
described
thing.
All my Git commits. This is fine.
Yeah, exactly. At least gets me off a computer screen. How about that?
A different keyboard.
Yeah.
I don't have a mechanical keyboard. Mine has, if you actually like piano, like I got wires in mine. This is
exactly.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. 3, 2, 1.
Thanks for listening to Ship It with Justin Garrison and Autumn Nash. If you haven't checked out our Changelog newsletter, do yourself a favor and head to changelog.com/news. There you'll find 29 reasons, yes, 29 reasons why you should subscribe. I'll tell you reason number 17. You might actually start looking forward to Mondays.
Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
28 more reasons are waiting for you at changelog.com/news. Thanks again to our partners at Fly.io. Over 3 million apps have launched on Fly, and you can too in 5 minutes or less. Learn more at Fly.io. And thanks, of course, to our Beat Freak in Residence. We couldn't bump the best beats in the biz without Breakmaster Cylinder. That's all for now, but come back next week when we continue discussing everything that happens after Git Push.